Love. It is indeed possible to consecrate ourselves through knowledge, through mental sacrifice, acquiring knowledge, knowing about the divine, knowing about the divine manifestation, and putting it at the service of the divine for its spreading. It can be a large and a wide sacrifice, and a pure one, bereft of the impurities of the lower nature. But for the seeker of the integral ideal, love brings in a certain richness, intensity and width in the situation. And the seat of love is the heart. The heart is indeed suspect to the reasoning, ratiocinative mind, because the mind is always suspicious of the moods, the undependable fluctuations of our emotions, and it would rather keep out the heart, which is the seat of emotions, out of bounds in the sacrifice of knowledge. But Sri Aurobindo points out, the tradition is strong and spiritual experience testifies to the existence of a divine element, of a divinity, which is the fount of all pure emotions and love in the heart. This contradiction between the emotive, unpredictable movements of the heart and its character being the seat of pure love is resolved when we take into account that, actually speaking, there is not one soul in man but two, not one heart but two. Most of us are aware only of the external, the outer heart, which is the seat of the desired soul, the emotive heart and the sensational being between themselves put forward a projection called the soul of desire, the desire soul. The desire soul attends exclusively to the fulfillment of the demands of the vital being and the emotional being at the service of the vital. But behind this surface soul, if we may call it so, there is the deeper soul, what is called in the Upanishads and the ancient treatises of India, the Self. Deep within, there is a small and a tiny spark of divinity, which in most people is so fragmentary, so tiny in shape, compared to the rest of the large being still in ignorance, that the sages have described it as no bigger than the thumb of a man, that is there in the mystic cave of the heart. As we discussed in one of our earlier talks, the seat of the this inner soul is not in the physical heart. It is behind the physical heart, behind what is called the cardiac center. There are veils after veils of consciousness that have to be crossed before we come to this luminous cave within, the heart cave as it is called, where burns this flame of divinity. This psychic element, this psychic essence, this soul spark, it is from there that all impulsions for the diviner movements of life issue forth. It is also the seat of what is called the immanent divine. For you are all familiar that the divine in manifestation has many poises. It is there above the manifestation, above the universe. We call it the transcendental. It is spread all over the universe, in the cosmos. We call it the universal divine. It is also within each form, within each movement, necessarily within each man, that is called the immanent divine. This immanent divine has its central locus in the inner heart of the being. This is the center, the real basis for the sacrifice to love to be built upon. As in the yoga of works, here too, there is a usual tendency to demarcate two areas of life, one called the mundane, supposed to belong to the ordinary movements of life, and the religious or the semi-spiritual, which support, buttress and encourage the Godward movements alone. That they are traditionally the activities of religion. A seeker of God is expected to eschew from him, at any rate from his alert consciousness, the mundane activities of life, and augment the area of religious and Godward activities alone. This, points out Sri Aurobindo, is out of question for the practitioner of the integral yoga. Our aim is to uplift all of life. It does not admit demarcation of life into zones, mundane or supramundane, religious or non-religious. All is divine and all shall be imparted the character of this inspiring divinity. For this purpose, this difference, this distinction does not hold good, nor does the other distinction made in society. The ethical movements inspired by ethics and those which are against ethics, this too does not properly belong to the spiritual domain. Ethics, after all, is a construction, a fine flower of the mental consciousness, struggling to eradicate from itself the vestiges of the animal past and to grow into the full figure of the manhood, enlightened manhood. Ethics is a self-imposed discipline by man to help him outgrow the animal past. Once man does it, once man becomes aware of the spiritual dimensions of life, ethics have no more claim to rule or govern his life. humanism which passes for spirituality in certain sections of humanity is only a diminution, at best a replication of the sense of the one divine in the universe at the level of mankind. But that by itself is not enough. Humanism, as a result of a spiritual consciousness, has value, spiritual value. But humanism as a goal, as an end in itself, doesn't carry one very further. Because ultimately, one moves within the circle of consciousness in ignorance, which has been chalked out by the present-day humanity. This yoga of love in work proceeds in three stages. First is to become aware of the soul, of the psychic center, and to develop it. As we discussed the other day, in most, the psychic is an influence. It is not a being governing the whole personality of man. It is severely conditioned by the state of the instrument through which it has to act from behind. The psychic is often compared to the king who is governed by the moods of his minister, the mind, the life, the physical being, the subtle physical being, all these function as so many wheels, or if they are activated, as so many instruments of the awaking psychic being. They can and do add their own elements to the psychic influence or psychic guidance that comes. They can, some of the parts, do pervert and put to their own use the contribution of the psychic being to the general evolutionary development. It is the aim of this, it is the business of the sadhak to be sincere to himself, see how far the intimations of the soul are allowed to come to the front in an undiluted form. The ways of mixture, the ways of tainting are devious, are unimaginably clever. Particularly, the vital mind is a cunning perverter. It is very convincing and very tempting to believe that the messages delivered through and received and transmitted through the vital mind are the psychic messages. But if one is sincere, one always knows, one can find out, because the psychic has its own brand, has its own qualities, the qualities of purity, of peace, of joy, not pleasure, of a deep oneness and harmony. To the extent these dynamic values operate in one's life, one can be sure that to that extent the psychic influence has begun to permeate his life movement. The voice of the psychic, there is a good deal of misunderstanding. I have known, possibly you also have known, many persons who have come to grief by listening to any voice that they hear within themselves, believing it to be the voice of the soul. There are so many beings, so so many impostors of the soul, and each puts in its clever voice. Very tempting. And one has to be sure 100 times before following the voice which claims to be the voice of the soul. In fact, I would rather put it that it is safer not to follow the voice of the soul, the voice that leads to come from the soul, unless it conforms to common sense, unless it is corroborated by the teacher, if one is fortunate to have a living teacher. As the psyche awakens and its influence spreads, one awakes to the existence of beauty. One begins to see beauty in nature, beauty in men, beauty in birds, beauty in forms, beauty in movement, beauty, to use the celebrated expression of Sri Aurobindo, is restored to its high office of interpretation of the eternal. The eternal, when it manifests in form, takes the shape of beauty. Where beauty is lacking, there the manifestation in form is not complete. As the psychic develops, as the psychic casts influence and light on the outer being, one awakes to the existence of beauty. One also awakes to the necessity of molding one's life in this form, in this figure of beauty. Similarly, one awakes to an uncaused joy. The joy is not caused from outside, not from any outside external factor, but it is a self-existent current of bliss. That circulates within, flows out with your very breath. And at its highest, it uplifts those in your vicinity. When you are in that mood, when you are in that psychic poise, there is an effortless elevation of your whole environment. Those who come around you, within your physical aura, they feel a certain warmth, a certain upliftment and an inexplicable purity about them. The characteristic power of the psychic being, however, is love. Love is the other face of divine beauty. Just as consciousness expresses itself in knowledge, force expresses itself through power and might, the delight of the divine, the ananda, the bliss, formulates itself as love. Love is the link between God and the world. It is also the link between man and God. Sri Aurobindo has described that love is the hoop of the gods, hearts to combine. In this multiplicity of creation, where forms are divided millionfold, when they are to be brought together, it is through the element of love, through the power of love, that the divine brings them together. Love is the hoop of the God, hard to combine. And love is there between forms on earth, between forms in creation, between men and men, men and women, men and birds or beasts, in any two units of creation, because it is the one divine that is indwelling in one form, cause becomes to the same embodied in another. Love, says Sri Aurobindo, is the yearning of the one for the one. It is because the same divine which is here in me is also embodied in you that there is an affinity, that there is a, what is called an attraction at our external level. There is a pull. There is an interchange. At the purest level, it is the one becoming aware of itself in different stations. But it undergoes many changes, many variations, and at each level it expresses itself differently. At the soul level, there is the pure love. At the mental level, there is a certain identity of interest. We call it affinity. At the physical level, it may express itself as passion, as attraction. But whatever it is, all these moments have at their back the love divine. Human love, what is called human love, with all its perversion, with all its diminution, is still or can still be made a channel, a door to reach the divine love. I remember it was at least 20 years ago that a young seeker who was in the ashram asked the mother whether a seeker, an aspirant who has taken to this integral yoga, should cut off human love, cut off from human love. If he has loved somebody, whether he should completely stop it. All of us had only one answer, based upon what we have learned, what we have read, what we have studied, and that it goes without saying it has to be done. But we were all flabbergasted when the mother said, no, do not cancel human love. Love, deepen it, enlarge it, take the best out of it. Allow yourself to consecrate, allow yourself to expand, allow yourself to give yourself, and you will reach the border which opens into the divine love. Should you deny yourself human love, it is most likely that the heart will get dried up and one side of your personality will be denied the divine manifestation in joy, in bliss. This is certainly not to be taken as a sanction for license, but as all things in God's creation, human love also can be made a step and a definite step to cross into the borders of the divine love. Naturally, human love is not determinant. At best, human love is a preparation, is a starting point. for the journey on the path of love. In its very nature, if one is sincere, if one is sincere in one's love, one cannot stand very easy. There has to be a self-giving of each to the other. One learns to eliminate selfishness, claim, demand upon the other partner, which are characteristics of human love. If it is not mere lust, if it is not simply self-regarding love, if it is not a self-regarding movement masquerading as love, love is a dynamic force. It touches certain depths of the being, awakens it to higher intensities of life, and prepares it. All depends upon the sincerity. Sri Aurobindo has said, love men, love God, fear not to love. From self escape, that is from your selfish circle, from self escape and find in love alone a higher joy. By love we find our kinship with the stars. If we learn to love our neighbors, our children, our neighbors, our community, our society, that way there is an enlarging circle of love and you reach the stars. By love we find our kinship with the stars. Love is the sign of one outblaze of Godhead that two share. To live, to love are signs of infinite things. Love is a glory from eternity's sphere, a base disfigured, mocked by baser might, that steal his name and shape and ecstasy. He is still the Godhead by which all can change. How does love grow? He describes love that was once an animal's desire, then a sweet madness in the rapturous heart, an ardent comradeship in the happy mind, becomes a wider spiritual yearning space. Love begins on earth but does not end on earth. Love is the bridge between earth and heaven. Love must not cease to live upon the earth, however. Love is the bright link twixt earth and heaven. Love is the far transcendent angel here. Love is man's lien on the absolute. It is this expanding movement of love that has to be cultivated, and nobody can truly love unless one forgets himself. One has to die to oneself before one can be born in the love divine. Even a ray, one single ray of divine love can alter the whole character of our life. This sublimation of human love into the divine love is a crucial step in this aspect of the integral yoga. It is a regular discipline which has to be applied from top to toe. There are, as I said, enemies at work within ourselves who lie ambushed, waiting for such pure and uplifting and transmuting movements to come forth. they twist it, they pervert it, and one cannot be too careful. Further, as the love for God, love for the Divine, begins to shape itself, one has necessarily to adore the Divine, to offer one's worship of love for the Divine at all levels. It is not difficult to worship the Transcendent Divine, the Lord who is above everything. But love for the Transcendent Divine is not complete unless that love is shared with all in the universe. The same Transcendent Divine is manifest in the universe in millions of forms. This love has to go forth to the whole Divine manifest in the universe, in men, in stones, in trees, in any form. And here we come to the crux of the worship of God in images, in stones, in idols, in figures, in icons. The original idea is indeed to perceive the Divine presence in these forces, in these forms where the Divine consciousness has been concentrated by an adept. Somehow, as it happens in the human world, the outer form has remained, the inner spirit has departed. The sadhak of this integral path has to keep that in mind, has to keep the formless in mind when he worships the form. Looming over the limited form is the presence. Looming over the limited form is the presence of the eternal, of the unnameable, of the undefinable, of the formless Divine. When you worship a stone, a tree, or even a man, a teacher, it is to this Divine that you offer your adoration. From this point of view, every movement in life has to be suffused with the spirit of love. Love not for oneself, not for one's interest, but one for love for the one Divine which is there indwelling in all. Last time we read a small paper on Sri Aurobindo and the Vedas. At that time I promised that we'll follow it up with Sri Aurobindo and the Upanishads. Most of you are aware what the Upanishads are, but the role that Sri Aurobindo gives to the Upanishads, the help that seekers of this yoga can derive from the Upanishad, that is dealt with by Sri Aurobindo in his commentaries, in his approaches, which he has written upon right from the beginning in 1910. This talk, which is to be broadcast on the 5th of this month. Sri Aurobindo approaches the Upanishad as a continuation of the Vedic tradition. He does not accept the verdict of certain modern scholars that they are revolts against the ritualistic spirit of the Vedas. He points out that when the full vigor of the Vedic age ebbed away, as is usual in all life movements, there was a period of eclipse which was followed by a movement of revival. of this movement, the brahmanas represent the effort towards the recovery of the ritual content of the Veda and the Upanishad, the knowledge content. These rishis of the Upanishad, Sri Aurobindo explained, seek to reclaim the Vedic truth, realize them in their own lives by means other than those natural to the earlier period, by means of the intellect yoked to the spiritual vision, and restate them in a language more suited to the mentality of a later age. He points out several instances of truth enshrined in the Vedic writ in terms of symbol and figure being presented in more direct and mentally more understandable language in the Upanishads. Nor does Sri Aurobindo agree with the conclusions of modern scholarship that the Upanishads are disjointed texts, contradictory in tenor. He is at pains to show how the authors of the Upanishads approach the reality from various possible angles, tread different paths to arrive at the same goal. The reality Brahman being multitudinous in its manifestation, their experience also is multiple. Each statement is valid from its standpoint. All find the reconciliation in the ultimate truth. These rishis are concerned with an unadorned statement of the spiritual experience in the language of the mind. They do not bother about logical consistency. The apparent gaps between one idea and another do not indicate missing portions, but necessary pauses that the mind needs before it passes from one real experience to another. The pauses are filled with the silence that prepares for the next revelation. Sri Aurobindo has translated the Isha and the Kena Upanishads with the commentary. He does not follow any of the schools of interpretation, but says what the texts mean to his uncommitted mind. He has also translated in English the Katha, Mundaka, Mandukya, Prashna, Taittiriya, Naitareya texts in full and the Svetashvatara in part, the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka in fragments. And what is the meaning of these ancient Upanishads? Simply put, in the words of Sri Aurobindo, it is this. The ordinary man who wishes to reach God through knowledge must undergo an elaborate training. He must begin by becoming absolutely pure. He must clean thoroughly his body, his heart, and his intellect. He must get himself a new heart and be born again. For only the twice born can understand or teach the Veda. When he has done this, he needs yet four things before he can succeed. The recorded revelation, the sacred teacher, the practice of yoga, and the grace of God. The business of the revelation, especially the Upanishad, is to seize the mind and draw it into a magic circle, accustom it to the thoughts and aspirations of God, to bathe it in certain ideas, surround it with a certain spiritual atmosphere. For this purpose, it plunges and rolls the mind over and over in an ocean of marvelous sound through which a certain train of association goes on ever rolling. In other words, it appeals through the intellect, the ear, and the imagination to the soul. But even when he has steeped himself in the original, he may not have understood all that it implies, the great mass of religious truth that lies behind, of which the Upanishad is but a hint or an echo. For this, he must go to the teacher. Awake ye, Arise and learn of God, seeking out the best who have the knowledge. Hard is it in these days to find the best, for the best do not come to us. We have to show our sincerity, patience, and perseverance by seeking them. And when we have heard the whole of the knowledge from the teacher, we still know of God by theory only. We must further learn from a preceptor the practical knowledge of God, the vision of Him, and the attainment of Him, which is yoga and the goal of yoga. And even in that, we cannot succeed unless we have the grace of God. For yoga is beset with temptations, not the least of which are the powers it gives us, powers which the ignorant call supernatural. Only the grace of God can keep us firm and help us over the temptations. The blessings of triumphant self-mastery that comes from long and patient accumulation of soul experience. Truly does the Upanishad say, sharp as the razor's edge is the path difficult and hard to traverse, say the seer. To conclude with a few of his renderings from the Upanishad, the self-born has set the doors of the body to face outward. Therefore, the soul of man gazes outward and not at the self within. Hardly a wise man here and there, desiring immortality, turns his eye inward and sees the self within us, within him. There the sun cannot shine, and the moon has no luster. All the stars are blind. There our lightnings flash not, neither any earthly fire. For all that is bright is but the shadow of his brightness, and by his shining all this shines. Two birds, beautiful of wings, close companions, cling to one common tree. Of the two, one eats the sweet fruit of the tree, the other eats not, but watches his fellow. The soul is the bird that sits immersed on the one common tree, but because he is not Lord, he is bewildered and has sorrow. But when he sees that other who is the Lord and beloved, he knows that all is his greatness, and his sorrow passes away from him. Any questions?